welcome to Narratives. Ellie Larkin writes environmental thrillers and strong female characters. In Devour, we meet a new protagonist, journalist investigator Olivia Wolf, undercover in the Middle East.
Olivia Wolf's head slams into the passenger window, dislodging the scarf that conceals her Western features, as a dented Toyota Corolla, Kabul's favourite car, bounces out of a pothole. Hastily covering her head, she fails to notice she is being watched by an old bearded mesher in a black turban standing at the roadside, who raises a mobile phone to his ear. "Can't we go any faster?" she asks Shinwari. Her driver and translator is a short man still wearing a Saddam Hussein moustache, who waves a hand at the makeshift market stalls, bottlenecking the narrow street ahead. It's December and snowing. Their progress is slow as they dodge haggling shoppers, bicycles, wooden carts, ancient cars, and overburdened skeletal donkeys. Street vendors in thick coats call out to passers-by, offering pomegranates, eggplants, carrots, cauliflowers, nuts and spices, freshly butchered meat, birds in cages, hot green tea in urns. Cars honk, brakes screech, men shout, chickens squabble. Behind the stalls, ramshackle shops compete for custom. One sign in English and Pashtun, offering a modern gym, is riddled with bullet holes. She's not surprised. Foreigners are not welcome. Snowflakes settle on sand-coloured, shattered shops and homes, and the slouching, weary shoulders of a people at war too long. Winter hides the beige city's wounds, but it does not heal them. Wolf spots a woman in a head-to-toe pale blue burqa, accompanied by a man she expects is the husband. "This is the first woman she's seen in the street." "Blue bottle," says Shinwari. He glances at Wolf and grins, but continues to lean over the steering wheel, as if somehow this will make the car go faster. She's heard that derogatory term before, back in her foreign correspondent days when she accompanied the Allied troops into war. The troops coined that expression, blue bottle. "Where are all the women?" she asks. Afraid. Accelerating around two boys pushing a bicycle, the horizontal crossbar laden with a bag of wheat they intend to sell, Shinwari then swerves across oncoming traffic to turn up a mountain road, on either side of which are box-shaped homes that appear to be carved into the sandy hillside. Children pick through the rubbish littering the slopes below. "I don't like this," Shinwari says. "One road in and one road out. Very dangerous." Her fixer of many years, Shinwari negotiates their way through roadblocks and no-go zones, offering bribery and banter to officials and warlords alike, so she gets her interview. She trusts his judgment, but this one is worth the extra risk. "I have to do this," she says. Shinwari shakes his head. The car lurches and the chassis scrape across exposed rock. Wolf fidgets in her seat and clicks the stud of her tongue piercing against her teeth. Earlier on, she was freezing. The car's decrepit heating system gave up the ghost years ago. But now, as her heartbeat quickens, she is stifling in her long brown Afghan dress. "Her husband is not there. You are certain?" Shinwari asks, his voice shaky. "He's in Tajikistan." Shinwari peers through the filthy windscreen as he searches for the right address, the lethargic wipers fighting a losing battle. "If Ahmed Ghaznavi knows you've been asking about him, this could be a trap." "Shinwari," she turns to face him. "I know what I'm doing. You know that, right?" "Yes, yes," he replies. "Going after Colonel Lalzad was just as dangerous. We exposed him for the torturer and killer he is. That's why he's now in a British jail, because of us." She squeezes his shoulder. "But he's still running his organisation from prison, and word is the drugs are funding an ISIL terror cell in the UK. So why you see Ghaznavi's wife?" "Ghaznavi is Lalzad's right-hand man in Kabul. He gets the drugs to England. Nouria Zia says she knows how the drug money reaches the man behind this British cell, and who he is." Shinwari's forehead is slick with sweat. "But why does she help you?" "She hates him. He raped her at 14. When she went to the police, she was convicted of the moral crime of being raped. Had his son in Kabul's women's prison. I did a story, remember? You got me the interview." "Yes, yes, but this is big risk for her." "Let me finish. Ghaznavi's first wife only gave him daughters, so he pressured Nouria into marrying him, legitimising his son. She wants to be free of him." Shinwari nods his understanding and focuses on the narrow road, a hairpin bend, fewer houses, a steeper climb. "You always thank me," he says. "Other journalists, they use me and leave. I thank you. Anytime, mate." He scans the street. The houses are bigger, better built. That one, Shinwari says, nodding at a mansion that is about as out of place as exposed cleavage is in Afghanistan. A poppy palace, of course, Wolf says. Shinwari whistles through his teeth. There is an 8-foot-high perimeter wall, freshly painted cream and wrought iron gate painted gold. Behind the wall, the house facade is dominated by 6 wide cream columns, the capitals at the top in gold and shaped like scrolls. These support 3 semicircular balconies and the floor above. Through vast sliding doors, Wolf can see a chandelier hanging from the ceiling. The rooftop is flat, supporting a large satellite dish, and is surrounded by a waist-high wall from which to admire the view or shoot intruders. I'll turn the car around, make our exit faster. Wolf tucks the wisps of her raven black bob under her scarf, then taps the deep pockets of her loose dress. In one is her smartphone. She'll record the interview with it. In the other is a long keychain that holds keys to hotel room, home, motorbike and locker at Kabul airport. She doesn't wear glasses, the sign of a foreigner, and her other body piercings are well hidden. Only her small black field pack, strapped tightly to her back, suggests she's not a local. The bag usually contains her laptop, satellite phone and spare battery, power adapter, a few items of clothing and a toiletries bag, all of which she left in the airport locker to save time and bulk. But the backpack stays with her, always. Attached to it by a clip is a metal water bottle with a long neck and screw-in plastic stopper. Her money and passport are hidden in a money belt beneath her dress. Earlier, Shinwari had asked her why she wore an almost empty pack. Protection, she'd replied. The house opposite Ghaznavi's is unfinished, the upper level exposed concrete breeze blocks. Another poppy palace. Shinwari parks outside. Wolf switches on her smartphone's video recorder but leaves it in her deep pocket. Her visit must appear social. Let's go, says Wolf, getting out of the car. She waits for Shinwari, then walks a few steps behind him. He tries the golden gate, but it's locked. To his left, he finds a bell to press. They stay silent and wait. Through the gate's swirling ironwork, Wolf sees a carved wooden door open. She tenses, ready to run. It is not Ghaznavi or his armed guards who step onto the porch, but a young woman in a pale pink silk dress embroidered with golden flowers, with a simple black Muslim scarf over her head. She hesitates and scans the street, then hurries to unlock the gate, opening it just a fraction. Nuria looks at Wolf, her jade-green eyes wide with panic. Wolf stares at the face of a frightened child. You must leave, Nuria says, her accent thick. Mina is watching, Ghaznavi's first wife. Can you meet us at the market later, Wolf asks. She shakes her head. There is a loud crack that seems to echo down the mountainside. Something zips past Wolf's cheek. Nuria jolts, eyes wide, as blood spurts from a hole in her neck. She collapses backwards. Wolf throws herself at a stunned Shinwari, and they hit the ground hard. On the roof opposite, she pants, sniper. She crawls to Nuria. The girl blinks rapidly in shock, blood pulsing from the wound. Help me, Wolf calls to Shinwari, but he's frozen with fear. She grips Nuria under the armpits and drags her behind a column. Wolf uses the girl's scarf to try and stem the blood flow. Shinwari scuttles after her. What do we do? He says, cringing behind the pillar. Kabir, says Nuria, her voice a gurgle as if she's drowning. Foamy blood seeps from her mouth. Kabir Khan, she chokes. Nuria, bomb London. The girl's voice dies away then. In one final act of defiance, she spits out the word Daesh, the Arabic acronym for ISIL or Islamic State. Another shot booms out. No silencer. The bullet thuds into the snow only centimetres from the column they hide behind. Nuria stares vacantly at the sky. A snowflake lands in her right eye and melts away into a tear.
You have been listening to L.A. Larkin reading from her book, Devour. The Narratives Library is produced by Karina Wynne-Moylan of Arts Canvas Bay FM 99.9.